Hello. Hey, this September, my wife Lindsay and I, we're going to celebrate 10 years of marriage. It's a big deal for us, all you seasoned married people out there. Oh, y'all, you're clapping. If you're a seasoned married person, you're like, Greg, talk to me when you hit 25, right? But for us, it's a pretty big deal. And we decided we wanted to take a trip, but given the circumstances, we know things are limited right now. One option that was presented to us, though, was Anaheim, California. I don't know if you know much about Anaheim, California, but it is home to Disneyland, and soon it will be home to a new Disney park themed around Marvel Avengers superheroes. Now, I don't have many places that I would describe as the promised land here, but a place flowing with superhero references and rides, I mean, like, that's pretty close. And there's a chance, though, that this park could be open around the exact same time that we would be going there to celebrate our anniversary. It was as if God, in his divine foreknowledge, had planned from the beginning of time to combine these two incredible things, my wife and superheroes, together in one celebratory, fashionable moment. It was going to be incredible. And so we talked about it, and as we did, this strange thing began to happen. We began to kind of assume that our children were going to be going to Disneyland with us. So we had this conversation. We're like, wait a second. This is our 10-year anniversary. We cannot have our children with us. But then we were like, wait a second. This is Disneyland. We cannot not have our kids with us. And so we were in a quandary. And here's where our conversation landed. We realized that Disneyland was great, and having Disneyland and the Avengers superhero theme park and our anniversary collide in the same time would have been awesome. But without the presence of our kids with us, it simply just wouldn't be worth it, because the place would have been pointless without their presence. Today, we're going to be talking about the topic of presence and experiencing God's presence. And as we follow along with Exodus 33, we will see how important it was for the Israelite people to experience God's presence, and how impactful it can be for us too, as people who have access to God's presence through Jesus and his indwelling spirit. But let me ask you something to start our time off. How mindful are you of God's presence? Do you think about this often? Is this something that you simply assume to be true, or is it something that you experience regularly? I gotta tell you, for the Israelite people in the book of Exodus, God's presence was everything. As you know, this summer we've been following along with the Israelite people and their big journey from slavery in Egypt all the way to the promised land. And in Exodus chapter 19, they stop and they camp at the base of this mountain called Sinai. And there, Moses, the Israelites' leader, he goes up to the mountain to meet with God. And while he's up there, God gives him 10 commandments. We probably know this, but what you might not have known is that aside from the Ten Commandments, God also gave Moses about 6 chapters worth of instructions on how to build this thing called the tabernacle. Why'd he do that? Well, Exodus 25, verse 8, he tells us. It says here, have them make a sanctuary for me, and look at this, and I will dwell among them. This tabernacle was going to be the place where God would take sanctuary, where he would dwell with his people, like his house in their neighborhood. He would be with them so that they can experience his presence. And by the way, this is the very first time since the Garden of Eden that God had promised to dwell among his people. So far up until this point, God was with the Israelites, but he was with them at a distance. God went ahead of them as a pillar of smoke and fire. God was on top of the mountain, and they camped down below. Even on this journey to Mount Sinai, there was this tent of meeting that God would use to meet with Moses. But even this tent was a distance set up from where the rest of the Israelites camped. But here in Exodus 25, God is promising to dwell with them. And this was everything to them. But if you know the story, you know how it goes. At the very same moment that God was promising his presence to the Israelites were proclaiming their allegiance to an idol. This is Exodus 32 that we talked about last week. They built a calf out of gold, and it kind of in order for them to have a God among them. And so as the story plays out, Moses comes down from the mountain, and there's drama. The calf gets destroyed, the people receive judgment, and Moses goes back up to the top of the mountain to meet with God and try to save the situation. This is where we're going to pick it up in Exodus chapter 33. We're going to start at verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt, and go up to the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants." So God starts off this conversation with them, and he says, go off the mountain, go to the promised land, the place that I promised all your ancestors. Verse 2, "I will send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey." Now key into here though. "But I will not go with you because you are a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way." He says, "I will not go with you. You can go. I will give you what I promised, but I'm not going to give you my presence." Why not? Because of this, because of the golden calf fiasco, there is now an obstacle keeping them from experiencing God's presence. Look at this phrase, stiff-necked. He says, "You are a stiff-necked people." If you've ever tweaked your neck before, you probably get this picture that when you hurt your neck, it's kind of hard to move it to the left and the right. It's kind of stuck where it's at. You can't go up, you can't go down. It's stuck. And this is how God is describing the Israelites. He says they're stuck in their ways. They won't take his lead. They won't obey. They are stubborn. They are sinful. That's the obstacle. And because of that, if God goes with them, he might destroy them. Now, don't hear this and think that God is saying, "I might lose my cool and destroy them." The picture I do not want you to have in your mind in this scenario is like the mom or the dad on a long road trip with their children. You know, like after they hear the 100th, "Are we there yet?" or "I need to go to the bathroom," 5 minutes after they left the gas station. The parents in that scenario may lose their cool. Words may be said. "Don't make me come back there. I will pull this car over." Or, "I will leave you on the side of the road." Nobody here has ever said that, right? No, don't have that picture in your mind. When God says, "I might destroy them," this is not a threat based off of his mood. This is a reality based off of his character. You see, God is holy, which speaks to his relationship with sin. It means that he is sinless, that he is separated from sin, and that he will not tolerate the presence of sin. And so for a people who have demonstrated the presence of sin in their life, say for instance by making a golden calf as an idol, they do not mesh well with God's holiness. For sinful people to be in the presence of a holy God, it's like a marshmallow to a bonfire. And look, I get it. This is not a happy picture of God's presence. But I think it's a helpful one for us. It's helpful because it reminds us that our nearness to a holy God does not come automatically. It also reminds us that the biggest obstacle for us experiencing God's presence is not God, but it's us. It's not that he'll destroy us because he's mad. It's that unless we have something that changes in us, our sinful state will make us unfit to be near him. And so in a way, God telling Moses, "I'm not going to go with you," is kind of a grace to the Israelite people. He's saying there is this obstacle between you and me. And so instead of going with you and destroying you, I'm going to send you. And I'm going to care for you, and I'm going to take care of you, but I won't be near you. I'm going to give you what I promise, but I'm not going to give you my presence. And I'm going to tell you this, this is the same grace that God gives every single human being who does not have a saving relationship with Jesus Christ. He still cares for them. He still sustains their life. He still provides for them, but he does so at a distance. Because without the change to our sinful state that Christ makes on his cross, a holy God will not be in the presence of sinful humanity. And so God, he offers this deal to Moses on this mountaintop. He says, I'll give you my promise, but I won't give you my presence. And I want you to see how Moses responds in verse 15. Then Moses said to him, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. I'm curious, how many of you would take the deal that God offered? I mean, like, how hard would it be not to refuse that or not to accept that deal? Look, I know we're in church, you're watching church and stuff, so we all kind of know the right answer, but I want you to go with me for a little bit. Would you be okay with God saying, I'll give you what I promise, but I won't give you my presence? Maybe your promised land picture is a land flowing with a great house and great family. Or maybe your promised land picture is that the image in the mirror would be flowing with hair and a slim waistline. Or that your demeanor in front of people is flowing with confidence and charisma. Your picture of the promised land, if God said, I'll give you that, but you won't have me, would you take that deal? For Moses, there was no substitute for him experiencing God's presence. At times, though, for us, if we are honest with ourselves, it could seem like the peripheral benefits that God places in our lives can sometimes look so attractive and more attractive than the presence of God in our lives himself. And when we let that happen to us, we begin to look to his promises as a substitute to his presence. I want to give you an example of this in my life. When I was in high school, I was, like many high school students, kind of insecure. I was afraid of being lonely, and I longed for community. That was my pictured promised land, to be wanted and to have attention. And it wasn't until my senior year of high school when I realized that the best place for me to find that attention and that community was at the youth group of the church that I was attending. I mean, I got more attention there than I did anywhere else. Everyone was friendly to me, especially the cute girls. There were fun games to play. There was food there. I had adults that cared for me and wanted to listen to me. It was awesome. And so for a time, I was okay with using the church to get to my pictured promised land, a great community and people around me that made me feel wanted. But the more I attended my youth group, the more I realized that there was this disconnect between what I was experiencing and what my peers were experiencing. I saw that my peers were experiencing something deeper than the food and the company provided. And it wasn't until I met God and experienced his nearness of his presence in my life that I realized that the most satisfying thing was not the gifts that God gives, but God himself. Look, you might be here because you are looking for the good things that God provides. Community, friendship, purpose, great music, trustworthy programming for your kids and for your students. All of these are good things. But there is no substitute for us experiencing the presence of God. And I would hope that whether or not you are a Christian yet, I hope that you would find that to be true. Look, you can get to your pictured promised land. You can get the house, you can get the job, you can find the image, but none of that stuff will give you the satisfaction that having God and his presence in your life will give you. Because when you have God, you can lose everything else and you'd still be okay. You can lose the house, you can lose the job, you can lose the spouse. Our government can descend into whatever political system you despise the most. Our church could never operate the way that you desire for it to operate. And if you have the presence of God in your life, you will be content. For Moses, the only thing that mattered was that God was with them. Moses says to God, like, don't send us. if you're not gonna go with us, we might as well just stay on this mountain to the day that we die. His singular focus was the presence of God and meeting him and him walking with him. And would that be for us too? I want to talk to seasoned Christians here for a moment. When you come here or when you join us online, what is your ultimate hope and expectation? Is it to hear the music that you like? Or is it that your favorite teacher would be teaching? Sorry. Or is it that the topic would be relevant to your life, or that you could see the friends that you don't get to see throughout the week? Look, you can get that each and every week and still not meet God. Or you could come here with an open, expectant heart, declaring to God that it doesn't matter what songs we sing. It doesn't matter who talks for 30 minutes. It doesn't matter who else is in the room with you. You are here for him. And there is no substitute for that. And so back on Mount Sinai, God offers this deal to Moses, and Moses just flat out, he refuses. And instead, he asks God to continue to go with this stiff-necked, stubborn people. And to that, God says, yes. But Moses isn't finished requesting. He has one more request for God. Exodus 33, verse 18. Then Moses said, now show me your glory. Show me your glory. I don't know about you, and I honestly, I don't like that this comes to my mind, but the picture that comes to my mind is the movie from the 90s, Jerry Maguire. I don't like that comes to my mind, but Jerry, the sports agent, he's on the phone with his only client, and he yells repeatedly into the phone, show me the money. It's actually the American film cinema's 25th most memorable movie quote of all time. But the reason that this line is in the script is to highlight what is driving their partnership, money, to see the money come in. Moses may have asked for anything in that moment. Show me the promised land. Show me the future. Show me what's going to happen next. But Moses doesn't ask that. He asks, would you show me your glory? For Moses, what's driving their partnership is not where God will lead them or what God would give them, but it's God's presence with them. That's what's driving him. So show me your glory. Last week, Pastor Randy gave us a great definition of glory. He said it is the weight of something or something's reputation. And so for Moses to say in this moment, show me your glory, it means, Lord, let me see you for who you are. I want to see all of you. And I want you to think about for a moment what Moses had already seen up until this point. I mean, he's seen a bush that is burning and yet not consumed. He's seen storms of hail, locusts, gnats, frogs, flies all descend upon Egypt. He's seen a river turn to blood, and he's seen a sea part right down the middle. He's seen bread rain down from the sky. He's seen water spring forth from a rock. He's seen a cloud of smoke by day and a pillar of fire by night. He's seen victory over enemies with his staff in the air. He has seen a lot of the blessings that God gives. But here he's asking to see the blesser himself. Show me your glory. He doesn't ask to see more from God. He asks to see more of God. And that is a request that God will make a way. Look at 19. Verse 19 says, and the Lord said, I will cause all of my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So he's saying, I am going to move, Moses. You're going to see me. I'm going to proclaim my name to you. My attributes are going to be on display before you. But you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. You see, God also knows that fully experiencing his presence in this way for a human is problematic. And here's the reason why. Because there is a glory that surrounds God. Remember, God is spirit. He's not energy or matter. And so when he reveals himself, he uses matter or energy to do so. For example, a cloud or a bush. In this case, it's his glory, which means this: it is a created light that is so bright because it reflects all of the pureness of his attributes. And it is so bright that nobody can look at it and live. I don't know, I get the picture like maybe the color is just so radiant that your eyes can't take it or your mind can't process it. In any case, God is saying like your mind would literally blow. But God will make a way for Moses to experience his glory. Verse 21. Then the Lord said, "There is a place near me where you may stand on the rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by." Then, verse 23. Nope, we don't have that. He says, "Then I will remove my hand and you will see my face," or "you'll see my back, but my face must not be seen." Here's the plan. Moses hides in a rock. God covers his face. And just before he passes by, God removes his hand so that Moses can catch just a glimpse of God's glory. I don't know about you, but I have questions. I don't know what to make of all of this. In some respects, this is such an incredible scene. I've never experienced this before. I mean, it seems like otherworldly. This has never happened to me. And yet, though, in a way, it has. And a scene like this has happened for all of us because there is a way to experience God's presence. We have been, in a sense, placed and covered so that we can know. Listen, God is not different than he was back in Exodus. He is still just as holy as he was back then. And just like the Israelite people, there is today for us still an obstacle for us experiencing God's presence. It's our sin. We disobey. We pledge allegiance to other things above him. And the result is that we cannot approach God and live. And yet, there is still no substitute for us experiencing the presence of God. We could have it all, and we'd still be found lacking. Only God can satisfy. And so the problem is this, is that while we cannot live with him, we certainly cannot live without him. But God makes a way for us to experience his presence. When we call out to him, God makes a way, and that way is Jesus. You see, Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the one in whom all of God's fullness dwells. And at the same time, Jesus was fully man. And so this made him the perfect bridge between a holy God and sinful humanity, but the bridge by which we go to God. It's through Jesus that we find salvation. It's through Jesus that God provided cover for our sin, the multitude of it through his bloodshed on the cross. It's through Jesus that we are now free from blemish and free from accusation. And it's through Jesus that we are presented now as holy in God's holy sight. And thus any obstacle between us and God have been removed. And it's through Jesus that we can have confidence now to approach God and be in his presence. And it's through Jesus that we actually receive the presence of God. Look, we don't need to go up to a mountain or construct a tent or a tabernacle. God is there, but he is also in us. He dwells with us. 1 Corinthians 3:16, Paul says this. He says, "Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's spirit dwells in your midst?" Paul is saying, don't you know that? You are the place that God dwells. The moment you receive Jesus in your life, you receive the indwelling of God's Holy Spirit, his presence mingling within your being. Do you not know that, Paul says? Do you forget that? I do. Sometimes I forget that I have access to God's presence. I'm not mindful of the fact that he dwells in me and he dwells in you right now, each and every day, every minute, because of your faith and allegiance in Jesus. And you have now the indwelling spirit of a holy God in you. Don't forget that. Remember that. Not just in like the mountaintop moments of your life, but in the very ordinary and normal moments of the day as well. Look, when people ask me how the last few months have fared for me and my family, I describe it the way that my brother-in-law described it to me. He said that there are now, it seems like there are now no chapters in the day. Like every moment just kind of blends back and forth. Everything seems pretty normal and ordinary. COVID-19, thankfully, hasn't really affected us much as a family. But what it has done, though, is I've struggled to experience God's presence. Because at times, it is normal and easier to experience the presence of God in the highest of high moments or the lowest of low moments. But we might tend to forget that the Spirit of God dwells in us in the relatively mundane. There is this guy in the 17th century who knew this full well. His name was Brother Lawrence. He, for 50 years, lived as a monk in a monastery, and he had two jobs. Number one, he would wash the dishes, and then number two, he would fix the sandals of the other monks in the monastery. I don't know about you, but it sounds kind of like parenting during the quarantine, if you ask me. His job was chores. And you would think that in the monotonous moments, day in and day out, Brother Lawrence would struggle to experience God. But instead, he thrived. And here's how he thrived. He had a practice of being aware of the indwelling presence of God. Look at what he wrote. He wrote in the Practicing the Presence of God, he said, "The time of business does not differ with me from the time of prayer. And in the midst of the noise and clatter of my kitchen, while several persons are at the same time calling for different things," parents, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? "I possess God in as great tranquility as if I were on my knees." Listen, when the days roll out and they're long, when the dishes pile up, when the kids are needy, God is there with you, dwelling in you, his spirit in you. You have access to him there, just like you do here in a worship service. And so what do? Well, there is a practice to experiencing the presence of God. You practice an awareness of the indwelling spirit of him in your life. When you are knee-deep in laundry, you talk to God as if he is there. And you listen to his voice in your spirit. When you are meeting with your boss and it's not going well, you rest with a mindfulness that God's spirit is in you, empowering you. When you are combing through job opportunities on the internet, weary because nothing has panned out yet, you close your eyes and you breathe and you remember that God is near. And he is taking care of you and your family, and he has gone before you as well. We practice an awareness of the indwelling spirit of God in our life that is bought to us and given to us through Jesus' blood. And when we do that, there is a result from experiencing God's presence. I want to show you one more quick look at Moses. In Exodus 34, he has this conversation with God. He sees God's glory, a hint of it, and he's given these two new tablets, and he comes down from Mount Sinai with these two tablets of the covenant law in his hands. But he was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. Moses spent time in God's presence, and it affected him. His face became radiant. It was as if a little bit of God's glory spilled onto his face. He was so bright that he would have to wear a veil or a mask over his face when he was with other people, which, by the way, is totally the reason that people around here are wearing masks today. Kidding. But here's the idea. is that God gives us his presence, his holy presence through Jesus. And that thing is important to us, better than anything else. And when we practice an awareness of this presence that we can experience through his indwelling presence in the highs and in the lows and in the middle, something happens. We are transformed. We become radiant. We begin to reflect the glory of the Lord to others around us. That's what happens when we practice an awareness of the presence of the indwelling Spirit in our lives. I want to close with this picture, my picture of what this looks like. Years ago, I was on a missions trip to Elderslie, Jamaica. One day, we traveled deep into the Blue Mountains, this remote area in Jamaica. And there, we visited an infirmary for the vulnerable population. This was, to be honest with you, a very desolate place. It was in the middle of nowhere. The building was run down, and it was full of sick and disabled and vulnerable people, most of which were just simply cast aside by their family. These people received maybe 3 meals a day of whatever the short staff could provide for them. These people, they slept in rows of cots in large rooms. They didn't have much, basically a few sets of clothing to their name. And as we visited, my wife stopped at the bedside of one woman. She was sick, she was malnourished, clothed in smelly linens, lonely, most likely reaching the end of her days. But she was beaming with life. She had a smile from ear to ear. And it wasn't just the presence of my wife there, though she does have that effect on some people. This woman was beaming. She was glowing, radiant. And when my wife asked what she was smiling about, this woman, in such a simple way, she said this. She said, "I have Jesus with me." And then she started to sing. She started singing there in that big room with that row of cots. "I have Jesus with me." Would that we experience such nearness with a holy God, knowable and made possible by Jesus' sacrifice, that no matter what happens around us, the presence of God's indwelling Spirit in us would radiate through us to the people around us so that they would know that we have Jesus with us. Let that start in this moment. We're going to sing a song called "Holy, Holy, Holy." And as we do, I just want you to picture the spot in your life where you need God's presence the most. What part of your day do you need to experience the presence? And as you sing, "God, you are holy, holy," I want you to picture that spot in your mind. We're going to sing our praises to God.